touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby.
Yes! Welcome to Scott Holman Podcast, back talking Houston Cougar sports. As always, we have a fully good vibes Cougar basketball slate of games to talk about, some important matchups on the horizon as well for both the men and the women, which is exciting. We got a couple sports that are going to be back in action. The new year, we're going to talk about, we're going to introduce a new segment, a whole lot going on tonight, and all of it positive, Dustin. I think these are kind of our favorite episodes, where there's a lot of stuff to talk about, but nearly all of it is positive. There's a lot of things to get into. Not to mention, didn't even almost 30 seconds into my intro mention the banner day that football had today for transfer recruiting, and a big commitment they got this past Saturday that we kind of sort of knew was on the horizon. A lot of really good stuff to talk about tonight, huh?
Yeah, we are only a couple of weeks, maybe a month away now from being really in the thick of, just half of the bunch of sports going on at the same time. But even with just only two sports really in season this past week, still, I think we got six sports, I think, that are worth doing stuff worth talking about this week, and excited to do a season preview, talk about two hoops teams that are both still undefeated in conference play, and football, like you said, having that having a strong day in the portal right here on day one of the college football offseason, the day after the rather lopsided national championship game that took place on Monday. So lots of good stuff to talk about, like you mentioned, and I've got 11 pages of notes. We should probably stop doing this intro and just jump into it all.
Certainly shall. We are proud members here of the 1012 Network, talking all things Big 12 over there, as well as a bunch of really awesome school-specific podcasts, sports-specific podcasts, even as Midwest Madness I've started listening to as the Big 12 season has kicked into high gear. Definitely get familiar with our future conference here. A year out, you could also listen to the 1012 pod as well, talking all things Big 12 over there. Our good friends, please give them a follow if you haven't done so already, at TEN12 Network on social media, the 1012 pod, Midwest Madness, and many others wherever you put podcasts in your ears. We of course are also brought to you tonight by our good friends at the good brand Homefield Apparel. You can save 15% off your first order of what is an incredibly deep, over 200 schools worth of premium vintage collegiate apparel. Though obviously, if you're listening to this show, there's a good chance you're most interested in the Houston Cougar collection, of which Homefield has a fantastic one. You can get incredible selection, t-shirts, a hoodie, a long sleeve tee, really great stuff over there. I am currently wearing the Phi Slamajama tee that's part of their collection there. Really great stuff. You could save 15% off your first order just by listening to this pod. You don't have to do anything else. You just have to listen to the sentence or two that I'm about to say. Use the promo code HOLMAN12, like Scott and Holman, at checkout. You're going to save 15% off that first order. You're going to support a friend of our show, and you're going to look pretty good wearing some real natty Cougar gear in the process. But Dustin, I can't bury it any further. The, of course, first thing we're going to talk about here in our 11 pages worth of notes and our six sports worth of stuff to talk about here is year now once again running space at the number one spot, Houston Cougar men's basketball team. You were for a pretty good amount of time here. We've seen the Cougars occupy the top spot in most of the advanced metrics, your KenPom, your Bart Torvik, even ESPN's BPI, Dustin, the evil worldwide leader that wants nothing to do with the Cougars being the number one team, had the Cougars number one in their in-house metric. But we also now see, with the losses of UConn and Purdue in the previous week of basketball, your Cougars occupying, not operating, the top spot. Let's talk about that. It's pretty exciting. I made a joke before we came on about, oh, ho-hum, oh, we're number one again. We're used to it now, but obviously very much joking there. It is something I hope never to get used to, and like I said the last time, there are many people out there who will be fans of good basketball teams who will never, ever get to see that team have the little number one tick next to their name, and I think for as long as we're running space in here, I'm going to enjoy it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I guess a spoiler alert, if you didn't watch Houston's two games from this past week and you're still waiting to listen to the podcast to find out if Houston won those two games or not, they did. We'll talk about those games in a little bit here, but definitely, like I said, it's a newsworthy item.
Get help. If you're doing this, I'm not saying don't be a big fan of the show. I'm not saying don't like the show. If you're like, you know what, I don't want to see JVA Francis block a shot, Marcus Sasser be one of the best guards in the country, I want to wait for Sam Dustin to talk about that. Just get help. I'm sorry. I'm not saying don't love our show, but get help, please.
Yeah, I was being a little bit joking. I assuming there probably aren't too many of you out there that are doing that, but yeah,
hope not.
Absolutely no newsworthy that the Cougs are back at number one. That's the AP poll. That's the coaches poll. It's KenPom. It's, like you said, basically every other advanced metric that I'm aware of. And you know, I think the fact that the pollsters have Houston first is no small thing, given that there are other very good 1-2 loss teams out there. I mean, look at Kansas. Don't look at them right now. Last I checked, they're losing to Oklahoma at home. So that might, no, yeah, they're down 7 with 7 minutes to go to Oklahoma at home. So it might ruin my entire point by the time this podcast finishes. But you know, Kansas, reigning national champs, 14-1, only loss in the season as of now, for the next 7 minutes or so, is Tennessee at a neutral site. They have 7 wins over teams ranked 41 or better in KenPom compared to Houston, who has 3 of those. You know, not to sound like a bad coup, if I'm a neutral observer with a top 25 ballot this week prior to the game against Oklahoma, I might have Houston, you know, number 2 behind Kansas. Heck, even Purdue, they're only lost by 1 point to a top 20 Rutgers team. They have wins over number 12 Ohio State, 13 Gonzaga, 15 Marquette, 23 West Virginia, 24 Duke. You know, I'm not saying all this to minimize what Houston is doing this year or anything like that. I bring this up to point out that, you know, Houston didn't rise back to number 1 in the poll by default or because of the fact that nobody else was having the kind of season that would deserve them being in that spot. Houston is number 1 because A, I think the voters respect the advanced metrics, which all love Houston, as you mentioned, and I also because the voters respect Kelvin Sampson. They respect this program and what Houston is doing. And, you know, I think also because anybody watching the sport of college basketball at this point realizes that Houston isn't some fluky flash in the pan team. They're a monster program that rivals anybody else in the country. And, you know, that's why you get to have the number 1 by your name, in addition to, you know, winning all but one of your games and just throttling a lot of teams.
No doubt.
The other piece of news we had to talk about before we get into the actual game recaps and talking about the games to come is a little bit less fun to talk about, and that is the news that came out today on Tuesday that Ramon Walker Jr. is taking some time away from the Houston Cougar men's basketball team. Had been noted that he had been dealing with, it sounded like, just kind of a bunch of injuries and stuff. Kind of explains why we haven't seen very much of him on the court this year, and we really didn't get any more specifics about you know, why Ramon Walker Jr. is taking time away from the team, whether that's, you know, getting frustrated with the injuries, maybe that's frustration with, you know, not playing even when he felt he was ready to go. Maybe that's, you know, we saw, you know, McCaffrey, I forget his first name, but the coach's kid up in Iowa who's just taking some time away to the team to just deal with some anxiety. So really could be any number of things that are, you know, leading to this scenario. It's impossible for us to tell and know from the outside with no inside information in this whatsoever. But, you know, obviously wishing the best for Ramon. You know, Kelvin Sampson, I think, phrased it as Ramon needs to take some time to focus on Ramon. And obviously that's there are a lot of things that are more important than basketball. And you know, getting your head straight and making sure you're in the right mindset is obviously, you know, and dealing with anything that and dealing with any issues that you have is more important than playing a game for sure. So obviously wish Ramon the best. Don't know, this might be, you know, taking some time away from the team might be step one, where step two is, you know, permanently moving away from the team and searching out for a transfer, whatever the case may be. And it may be the case that, you know, he takes some time away and gets his head right and then comes back and then is, you know, playing for this team by the end of the year. Obviously that's the resolution that we're all hoping for, but you know, either way, you know, seems like a great kid, and obviously I know we're both just you know, wishing the best for him and hoping that everything you know, works out for him you know, to the best possible result.
Yeah, no, I don't think we'll speculate too much of the why, because we don't know, and I think we won't ever be told exactly. I think it should definitely remain private, like Kelvin Sampson, Ramon working Ramon. And I thought it was important that he clarified that Ramon was still a part of the program. But I think, yeah, understandably left it pretty vague. I mean, respect his privacy. And certainly a player we've really enjoyed watching in the past season or so he's been in the program. I, like you, certainly hope he'll continue to be a part of the program, though. I think above that, I think higher priority than that is that I would rather him be happy playing basketball, because there's a good guy there, and there's certainly a good basketball player there, whether it's at U of H or at another school. And would love nothing more than Ramon Walker Jr. just be happy playing basketball, because he's quite good at it, and I think brings some things to the table that, yeah, I think only it's not like a, oh, it's his 3-point shot. The ability to go out there and just dive for the loose ball like he did in that dramatic overtime win at Wichita, a loss that the Cougars could not have taken, a critical play at, you know, a really critical juncture of the season when the Cougars really needed him. We talked about when we did that season recap show, our premium feed, plug there. Ramon Walker Jr., having barely really played college basketball, having to play significant minutes for the Cougars because you only had seven healthy scholarship players against Temple in a critical road game early last year. The contributions he's given you, and again, we'd just like to see him happy playing basketball wherever it is, because I think he seems like a really fantastic guy and certainly a fantastic basketball player as well.
All right, and then pivoting, let's go ahead and talk about some actual Cougar men's basketball games. They've had two of them since our last episode, a couple of victories to move to 4-0 in conference play. Started with a beatdown of rival SMU, an 87-53 final. Fun start to the game. SMU scored the first basket of that one to take a 2-0 lead, and then Houston scored the next 24 points unanswered to put this game away just minutes in. You know, the Mustangs did kind of briefly gain some traction and at least played Houston relatively even for the rest of the first half after that big run, but, you know, ultimately Houston only ever extended its lead, ended up beating the Mustangs by 34 points, tied for their second biggest all-time margin of victory over SMU in 91 meetings. And, you know, a couple of things that we talked about in the game preview really stood out for me in this one. We talked about SMU leading scorer Jerick Phelps and how he was, you know, banged up and we didn't know if he was going to play or not, and how much he was going to play, how well he was going to play. And he did start. He played 25 minutes, which was tied for the team high, and Houston's guards did do a great job on him, holding him to 6 points on 2 of 11 shooting, but he pretty clearly wasn't playing at 100%. He actually didn't play in SMU's following game, a blowout loss to UCF. And, you know, here Kelvin Sampson even himself said after the SMU game that, you know, he expects that Phelps will be a lot healthier and more effective and more himself and much closer to 100% when these two teams face off again up in Southern Oklahoma next month. You know, and clearly, healthy Jerick Phelps versus less than 100% Jerick Phelps was not the difference in who won the game. But, you know, him being banged up definitely, I think, eliminated any small chance that the Mustangs had of keeping this one respectable. And then also in the game preview, we talked about SMU not having the bodies inside to contend with Houston, and that very much played out in this one, I think even more dramatically than the Phelps thing, because Houston's forwards just were doing whatever they wanted all game long. Jairus Walker looks like an NBA player going against JUCO guys, which isn't super far from the truth, I don't think. Had 23 points on 10 of 16 shooting and 10 boards in just 25 minutes of action. And as a team, Houston better than doubled up SMU on the glass, 54 rebounds to SMU's 26. The Cougs actually grabbed more of their own misses than SMU did, with 21 offensive rebounds to SMU's 19 defensive rebounds. That allowed Houston to have a ludicrous 35-6 edge in second chance points. Cougs were also plus 14 points in the paint. And, you know, part of that is SMU not being the best rebounding team and you know, not having by any stretch the best forward group in the country. But, you know, a big part of that also is Houston having an incredibly talented, incredibly tough group of forwards and a, you know, budding future star in budding future NBA star, I should say, in Jairus Walker, who seems to be really figuring things out in a hurry right now.
I think by its nature, a 34 point win is always going to be pretty decisive for the team that's on the right side of that 34 point margin. But I think you can kind of contrast this one with Tulsa, which was surprisingly close for 10 or 15 minutes before the Cougars just kind of dropped the hammer on that one. Cougs opening on a 34-4 run after SMU made that first basket, like you talked about, pretty emphatic. This one was not in doubt for a good 30-ish minutes of game time, which even for a team like U of H that has had a lot of very decisive wins this year, I think is on the high end there. And so much of that absurd run was Jairus Walker and SMU having precisely nobody who could deal with everything that Walker can do offensively. I think you saw SMU at different points try Samuel Wilson and F.A. Odigi, and it didn't work when they tried to match Walker's physicality in the low post. It didn't work because they really didn't seem to be prepared for the fact that he's actually willing to take three-pointers, especially if SMU just was going to make a business decision not to really contest very many of those three-pointers. And I'm not going to say Jairus Walker was the only guy who contributed to the dominance. You had five guys in double-digit scoring from last week, but I think it was just the complete inability of anyone SMU had on their roster to check Jairus Walker. I think that was the most terminal problem for SMU. SMU had a lot of terminal problems, including but not limited to Jerick Phelps not really being healthy for this one. I think he was out entirely for their next game at UCF, another pretty decisive loss for the Ponies. And I think in this one you also saw the selflessness of this Cougar team, that you have a guy like Marcus Sasser, who's a senior. He's, I would say, ostensibly your go-to guy more nights than not offensively. You saw him early on during that 34-4 run immediately defer to Walker, immediately realize that there was nothing SMU was doing out there to slow this guy down, and I need to do my part, even as a senior, even as a guy who's on track for an All-American type season, to make sure Jairus Walker gets the ball as much as possible. To have a guy like Marcus Sasser be your go-to scorer and also be able to have a night like the night against SMU and finish with 7 assists, I think speaks to that selflessness that I think you've also seen from Walker in previous games. You have not seen this guy sulk or show bad body language, and he didn't get as much of the ball when Marcus Sasser, Tremont Mark, other guys were having the hot hand, were doing the most effective things offensively. I don't think you've ever seen him be anything other than a team player, and not something you could probably say for every single consensus five-star All-American Jairus Walker kind of recruit. And certainly, this is SMU's worst basketball team since either Larry Brown's first year there or probably most of the run of our good friend Matt Doherty there.
Coach,
I even put Coach Doe in the notes that I refrained from using. I'm glad you kept me honest. I'm glad you made sure we got a Coach Doe reference in there one last time. I still thought it was impressive, though, how emphatic of a beating this was. And it made me wonder afterwards, like, how did this SMU team beat, like, pretty good Iona and Utah State teams? I mean, I realize those were neutral site games in Hawaii, and, you know, body clock does different things to different college athletes, but also kept it surprisingly competitive against a TCU team that's near the top of the Big 12 all games in the last month, and that they looked like just completely tapped out for the last like 25-30 minutes of this game. You saw, and they were mad. You saw that flagrant foul from Emery Lanier, real cheap shot there in the last several minutes of this game. And he apologized. I'm not going to make too much out of it, but I think that's been something that's also been so notable from some of these blowout wins. Certainly, you know, these blowout wins over Tulsa and SMU, is even when the Cougars are up 30-something points, there's no lack of effort. You don't see the Cougars shift into a lower gear and take it easy. This team really has only one speed, and I think it's really impressive to see. I don't think we've ever had a team that's been deep enough and talented enough to just, even when you sit the starters for the last 7-8 minutes of the game, to just still do what the Cougars have done to some conference opponents. It's pretty doggone impressive, even against an SMU team that I think certainly we expected to be a comfortable win going in.
Yeah, overall, you know, all-around team win, like you mentioned. And as much as I started off raving about Jairus Walker and Houston's forwards, the guard group played really well, too. I mean, you mentioned Marcus Sasser tying a career high with 7 assists. And such a good score that even in a game when he was deferring to his teammates, and even in a game when he was, you know, taking a seat late on in the game so that the backups could play, still scored 14 points and just had one turnover to go with all that. Tremont Mark, an efficient 10 points, would have easily had more if this game were competitive after the first 10 minutes. Terrence Arsenault, I thought, had a really strong week, starting with 10 points and 6 boards in just 10 minutes in this one. And Emmanuel Sharp, you know, one of his colder shooting nights as a Coug, still contributes by grabbing 9 rebounds off the bench. So just really up and down this lineup, we see this guard group getting better, we see this forward group getting better, and it's just this Houston team just, yeah, they can hurt you and beat you in so many ways. You know, if you've got any one weakness, this team has just got the talent and the players that they are going to be able to find it and exploit it. And they're just getting better and better at that as the season goes on, and really impressed by what we saw in this game for sure.
I think the only other notes I had for this one, I just wanted to repeat some of my favorites about this one. This was the most decisive win since 1978. Dustin, you have to go back to February of 1978 to find a game where U of H beat SMU by more points. And just my personal favorite, SMU is going to end this series having lost their last 6 games on U of H's home court.
Beautiful.
Yep, awesome. Just one more time we have to face these guys, and hopefully another pretty decisive one up in Dallas.
All right, then a less decisive but still impressive win. Houston pulled away to win at Cincinnati 72-59. This one certainly stayed competitive longer than the SMU game. Houston went up 18-12 early, only to see Landers Nolly hit a pair of triples to tie it up. And while Houston went on a 15-5 run from there to take a 10-point lead, Cincinnati kept fighting, got the halftime deficit down to 7. And, I mean, I certainly during halftime was having flashbacks to the Alabama and UCF games where Houston had a double-digit lead but didn't put the game away and then came out, you know, with their foot off the gas in the second half and let their opponents get back into the game, and obviously kind of had differing results, but very stressful games Either way, that was not the script for this one. Houston opened the second half on a 15-2 run to take a 20-point lead. And while Cincinnati did keep scrapping and at one point got within 10, it never really felt like Houston was in any danger of letting this one get away after that, as they ended up with a 13-point victory. And that was definitely my biggest standout from this one, Sam, was just we talked previously about how you don't want to make a habit of coming out in the second half with your foot off the gas. Houston put the pedal to the metal in this one, and that carried them to a win in what was, you know, I thought one of the tougher remaining games on the schedule.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of followed the pattern of the previous week of Cougar basketball. We expected the weekend opponent to be a bit more competitive than the one we saw on the weekday. Cougars traveled to Fifth Third Arena playing last time between these teams as American Conference members, though I expect we'll see plenty of the Bearcats with both programs joining the Big 12. And this one, obviously, certainly much more competitive than the SMU game, but I don't know if this one was close for long enough that I ever really started to get anxious in the same kind of way that I did for, say, the UCF game. I mean, once Landers and Ollie stopped hitting every shot he threw up, I think, which is right around when the Bearcats tied it at 18, I think about 10 minutes of game time elapsed, I don't think I ever really saw a clear way for the Bearcats to stick in this one and make the Cougars uncomfortable. I mean, they kept it within arm's reach. It was a 7-point game at halftime, but I really enjoyed seeing the Cougs go out and kind of take the game by the scruff of the neck in the second half. I think this hasn't been a bad second half team by any stretch, but I think you're going to have to kind of squint and parse and nitpick to find any weakness with the current number one team in the country. And you can honestly say the Cougars have had some kind of lackluster second halves, the loss to Bama, and I think that closer than comfortable win over UCF. And this game wasn't iced in the first 5 or so minutes of the second half. I think there was a way since he could have theoretically come back. I didn't just immediately at that point be like, okay, well, we've for sure won this. I think I'm still cautious enough of a fan that I don't ever really feel comfortable when it's to, I would say, Dustin, to about the 15-point mark with about 4 minutes left. But I will say that 15-2 run out of halftime, it just made it extremely difficult. Even with the Bearcat big man, Victor Locken, having a really nice second half, Mike Adams-Woods, arguably, I think, playing his best ever game in a Cincy uniform, even with those two things happening, this never got within inside double digits again. And I think Sunday was a display of how otherworldly Jairus Walker can be coming off that really great performance against SMU. And whatever the Bearcats tried, whether it's Jeremiah Davenport or any other front court guy, they just could not keep Walker from scoring basically whenever he wanted. And even though the Cougs allowed more points in their absurdly low, somewhere around 50 points season allowed average, I was just really impressed with the Cougars' ability to defend and harass and keep the Bearcats from ever seeming to get into any kind of rhythm offensively after maybe the first 5 or 6 minutes of the game. I think if you wanted to look at one stat and really say that the game was decided on that, I mean, it's got to be that 26 points off turnovers the Cougs had versus a Cincy team that came into this one top 25 in turnover percentage, and a team that was improved offensively and certainly was good at not beating themselves. And I thought you saw certainly from Marcus Sasser, those 5 steals were a nice reminder that for all the offensive flash he has, for all the ability he has there, he's still every bit the elite junkyard dog kind of defender that you would expect all Kelvin Sampson team guards to be. Wasn't the fewest points the Bearcats scored in the current season, but was the fewest they've scored in their home court by a pretty good margin. I wouldn't be surprised that it holds till the end of the season, because I did see a Cincy team last Sunday that I thought was significantly improved on the offensive end over the team we saw a year ago, but not really a team that could hang with the Cougars. And in a lot of ways, I think really Sunday was about, I think, as close to the best case scenario offensively for Cincy as you could have realistically asked for. Landers and Ollie and Michael Woods combined to go 7 of 8 on 3-pointers. Victor Locken had a good game and the Bearcats grabbed 15 offensive boards. And yet this one was still a 13-point final deficit on your home court. And that, I think, 13-point final margin might have flattered the Bearcats a bit for how they played in the second half. It wasn't, again, the dominant kind of scoreline that you saw for the SMU game, but it was never going to be that. And I was impressed the Cougars made this as stress-free as they did. This isn't the Cincy of old, but I would have been very happy if you had told me this was going to be a stress-free Sunday win. I'm just worried we're going to go in on one of these Sundays and some team is going to be like, we're playing the number one or number two, whatever we are, team at the time. And you're just going to get a rabid crowd. Shots aren't going to be falling. And we're going to get a conference loss. And I mean, I'm not scared of that necessarily happening. I mean, we've seen this team lose before, and I think this is going to be still a very good team when it's all said and done. But I was very glad to see a stress-free win that never really had me considering those hypotheticals about this being the weekend the Cougars get upset in conference play.
You mentioned the crowd, and that's one thing that's really stood out to me from Houston this year, is even playing on the road, you expect to get the raucous crowds for the, you know, number one, number two, number three, whatever Houston is in a given week, team coming into your building. And I feel like we haven't ever had a game where the opposing crowd ever really got into it for any sustained period of time, that every time the opposing team does anything, makes any kind of run that gets their crowd really amped up and into the game, that Houston just has this preternatural ability to just silence the crowd, whether it's Marcus Sasser or Jairus Walker or somebody else making a big emphatic play to kind of shut everybody up and set them down. And that was the case here. You know, occasionally you'd see Cincinnati do something, and it just felt like every time their crowd was like, okay, yeah, we're going to get into this. We're really feeling this. Houston would just make a play or two and just kind of take the air out of the room. Another thing that's just been so impressive, you know, Houston's so good on the glass, so good in the, you know, turnover margin. You see an opponent often play Houston kind of essentially break even in one of those categories, but almost never both. The SMU game, they did a great job, you know, turnovers. It kept Houston pretty even. Houston killed them on the boards. Cincinnati actually rebounded real well, actually out-rebounded Houston in this one slightly. But Houston, like you said, won the turnover battle 17-7, won points off turnovers by 22-point margin in a game that they won by 13 points. That's a pretty dramatic cause and effect right there. So really impressive. Jairus Walker continues his unbelievable week, even reportedly dealing with an illness that made him a game-time decision. Still ends up with 21 points, 5 rebounds, 3 steals. And I liked, one of the other things I liked from this one is seeing Terrence Arsenal get minutes while this game was still very much TBD. Earlier on, and you know, the last couple of games that have been real close, Alabama and UCF, we've mentioned the only guard that came and got minutes off the bench was Emmanuel Sharp, as he was apparently the only guard that, you know, Kelvin Sampson was comfortable enough with the way he was playing and in terms of his health, in terms of putting him out there in a game that was very much up in the air. And while this game in the first half was definitely still up in the air, and even like I said, in the second half when it looked like Houston was probably going to win but definitely didn't have it iced away, Terrence Arsenal was still getting some minutes. You know, the numbers don't jump out at you: 4 points, a rebound, an assist, a block, and a steal in 14 minutes. But, you know, I thought he made a lot of really high IQ plays in this one and looked as college ready as we've seen from him. And then, you know, some of the things I liked from this one, the fact that Juwan Roberts leading Houston in shot attempts in a game is not only something that happened in this one, but doesn't even really seem that strange. Didn't have one of his most efficient nights, missed a couple of little hook shots we usually see go down for him, but shot just 7 of 16, but no big deal. Still ends up with a double-double, 14 points, 11 boards. Marcus Sasser, 16 points, 6 boards. You mentioned the 5 steals. And then Tremont Mark just filling up the stat sheet as well, 10 points, 5 boards, 5 assists, 2 steals, just 1 turnover. Extremely impressive all-around victory for Houston. And, you know, it is just wild seeing, you know, the many, many things that kind of make you stop and really take stock of how far this program has come. You know, I remember early years in the American and thinking, you know, we are never going to beat Cincinnati and that, you know, the win at H&PE Arena that I'll remember forever of the, you know, holy crap, we're actually going back to the NCAA tournament. We beat Cincinnati. Houston has now won 5 games in a row against Cincinnati by an average margin of 21 points. It's wild. It's crazy stuff. And I feel like we come on here every week and say it, but like I said, you only get so many weeks when your team is number one in the country and just blowing the doors off of most everybody. So definitely going to take a minute and appreciate how cool it is seeing Houston just get dramatic victory after dramatic emphatic victory over the Bearcats.
I'm glad you mentioned those 5 wins in a row. I had something at the end of my Cincy game specific notes actually about how the Cougars have won 8 of their last 10 in this series, but maybe the wildest one to me is winning 3 of the last 4 that have been played at Fifth Third Arena, going back to that 2019 regular season finale where Corey Davis just shot the lights out of the arena and the Cougars guaranteed themselves sole possession of the American Conference Championship in 2019. That was the kind of program we aspired to be. Like, when we looked at Cougar basketball in the first year or two of Kelvin Sampson, like, yeah, he's got a point in the right direction. He's definitely squeezing all the juice you could possibly squeeze out of this program with years and years of just not mattering, years and years of bad sport. Like, he's starting to get everything out of this program that you can. Boy, it would be nice if someday that the stars aligned and the resources increased or what have you, we could be a Cincinnati type program. And that was just us dreaming of being consistently top 25 and comfortably in the field of 68, not necessarily being a top 5 number 1 kind of program, which I think it's pretty cool. And just the fact that this opponent, who just we for the longest time had the absolute most lopsided record against, that we've actually regularly beat them. And that's, I know, not the best selection of Cincy teams the last two or three years, but we were starting to beat them under Mick Cronin. And that was kind of the, I think, real first statement that this was a serious program, that this was going to be not just a good year's team, this was going to be a good team for the foreseeable future. And nice to not end the series with Cincy, because again, we expect to be regularly playing them as Big 12 members in the coming seasons, but to kind of end this chapter at the end of the month and ending, you know, against the Bearcats on a pretty dominant run, I think it's very exciting, and just another statement of where this program has come in the last 5-6 years.
All right, and turning our attention to Houston's future matchups here, the Cougs will be hosting South Florida on Wednesday at the Fertitta Center. The Bulls come into this one with a 7-9 overall record, including an 0-3 start to American Athletic Conference play. Actually lost their first 5 games of the year, including losses to a trio of 200-plus ranked teams in Southeast Missouri State, Stetson and Austin Peay. They then rebounded to win 7 of their next 8 non-conference games, although their best win on that stretch was over number 120 Hofstra. And then they started conference play with another losing streak, falling to Memphis, Temple, and Wichita, those last two coming at home. So KenPom currently sees them as the 176th best team in the country as of this afternoon, making them the second worst team in the American, well ahead of Tulsa and marginally behind SMU and ECU. And despite being a team that's, you know, probably marginally behind SMU, I do think they've got some players who could play for a lot of teams in the country. They're led by 5'9", fifth-year senior guard Tyler Harris, previously of Memphis and Iowa State. He's averaging better than 15 points a game this year. And inside, they've got 7-foot big man Russell Chihuahua, good player, averaging 11 points, 8 rebounds, really good rebounder. But one has also, I don't know if you saw this, Sam, so you can tell me if you have the stat in your notes here. One of the most bizarre, incredible stats I've ever seen. I had to triple check this on like 3 different websites to make sure this wasn't a typo or a glitch. Russell Chihuahua, 7 feet tall, started every game for USF, second on the team in minutes played with like 475. How many blocks do you think Russell Chihuahua has in the year, Sam?
I feel like you're asking me this because it's low, and I promise I have not, Chi. I promise correct, I have not correct. Used your time talking to Google Russell Chihuahua USF stats. I'm going to say, is it 475 minutes you said?
475
minutes.
I'm going
to say 8 blocks.
See, even that is not low enough. The number is 2. 2.
Wow.
He has the same number of blocks that Tyler Harris, who is 5'9", has.
Listed 5'9", too, so we're probably talking about a guy who's really like 5'7", 5'8". Sorry, Tyler.
He blocked one shot in the first game of the season against SEMO. He blocked one game against UMass at the end of November. And since then, the 7-foot-tall human being has played 250 minutes of competitive basketball and not blocked a shot. He's not a bad player. He's got a nice inside game. He's a good rebounder. But I completely blows my mind. I don't know how you have can possibly be that tall and have 2 blocked shots. Mind-blowing. I literally am not joking. I looked it up on 3 different websites this afternoon to make sure that it wasn't a mistake. But he's blocked 2 shots.
That's wild.
All year. Wild. A couple other players just wanted to throw out there, though. Kansas State transfer Selton Miguel, their third double-digit scorer on the year, 6'4 guard, originally from Angola. He usually comes off the bench, although he did start their last game. Either way, he'll end up playing a bunch of minutes. He's a good offensive creator, top 200 nationally in assist rate. And I think kind of maybe the X factor if USF is going to play a little bit better the rest of the year than they have up until this point is Keyshawn Bryant, South Carolina forward that they added via the transfer portal this offseason. Fifth-year guy. He's been banged up and missed a lot of time, but he looks to be pretty healthy now. He scored 31 points over their last 3 games. Maybe he comes and closes out the year strong and gives them a little more depth, but I think even that best case scenario, Sam, gives them 4 guys who are like fine, 0 guys who I would call a bona fide star, and I just don't think that that's really enough talent to hang with a team like Houston.
I would agree. I think this is certainly a better USF team than last year's group, which finished dead last in the American, was one of the 10 or so worst offensive efficiency teams in all Division I. And I think a better team than we expected after they lost their season opener to SEMO, ended up losing their first 5 games of the season. They've kind of rebounded against not the strongest non-conference, but haven't been uncompetitive any of their American Conference losses so far. I mean, case in point, less than 2 weeks ago, this group went to Memphis and they lost 93-86, but it's worth noting this is a game where they led by 10 over Memphis well into the second half before the Tigers ended up closing this one on a 14-0 run to avoid what would have been an embarrassing loss. And I mean, I get it, a loss is a loss, but I think it was a surprising effort from the Bulls in a positive way. But, you know, unfortunately, more recently, they've had that pair of 4-point home losses to Temple and Wichita State, and that loss to Wichita kind of a flip at home of the loss to Memphis, gave up a 14-2 run to close that game after looking like they were about to beat the Shockers, get in the win column in conference play. And I guess I would be more optimistic if I was a USF fan about this competitiveness, about the team looking like it had a bit more of a pulse since the first several games of the season. I would have a bit more optimism if it was a situation like ECU. ECU has a new head coach. They have a pretty young roster, but that's not the case here. This is head coach Brian Gregory's sixth season. This is a pretty veteran roster, I believe inside the top 75 nationally in roster experience. You mentioned Tyler Harris from Memphis, fifth-year guy. Keshawn Bryant from South Carolina, another fifth COVID senior guy. Good players, and a number of guys in the rotation who are playing at least their fourth season of college basketball. Russell Chewa, one of those fourth-year guys who has that incredible block stat that I have nowhere in my notes. So props to that, Dustin. I just have that he's a solid, improving big man. I think impressive, especially because he missed most of the offseason back in his home country of Cameroon with a visa issue, which has thankfully, for his sake, been resolved, averaging 11 and just under 8 boards per game, has had multiple offensive rebounds in all but two of the games he's played for USF. I would say probably the biggest reason individually why this South Florida team is top 50 nationally in offensive rebounding percentage. And I think it's just hard to see how the Bulls are going to be able to score enough points with, like you said, I think four guys who are some degree of solid to decent, but no bona fide stars, and just how they're going to score enough points to stay in this one, despite, I think we'd agree, being a considerably improved team from last year. This is a good offensive rebounding team. They aren't as catastrophically bad at putting the ball in the basket as they've been in some recent seasons under Brian Gregory, but other than that offensive rebounding and being decent, not turning the ball over, I think this is by definition a below average team in most of the other measurable key areas offensively. Also, for seemingly the umpteenth year in a row, Dustin, this team is awful at shooting free throws. They're currently 347th in the country at making free throws. In the last five seasons, Dustin, the last five seasons, USF's best free throw shooting season was when they were 327th in the country in the 2019-2020 season. You'd think one of these years they'd just luck into being an average or even just slightly below average free throw shooting team. You'd feel like they would run into a guard who was just a really good free throw shooter and was good at getting to the line. At this point, it's got to almost feel like a stylistic choice, right? To only recruit guys who are bad at making free throws. You'd feel like at some point you would just eventually not be awful. I'm not saying being great. I'm not saying become a national top 50 team. I mean, we've seen a number of extremely good U of H teams in the last four or five seasons, and none of them were really anything other than maybe slightly above average at shooting free throws. But at some point it's you, right? At some point it's got to be something you're doing consciously or subconsciously in terms of the players you're bringing to the program.
Yeah, it is bizarre. I think the other crazy Russell Chewa stat is that he's shooting 60% from the free throw line this year. And of the seven guys on USF who have at least 10 free throw attempts, he's the third best free throw shooter at 60%. That's rough. That's pretty bad. And yeah, you kind of, my last two bullet points here to talk about this game, kind of talking over things that you already mentioned. They're not very efficient offensively. They don't shoot a great percentage from the floor, even though it is an improvement over the last couple of years. They don't get to the line very much, which is maybe a blessing when you're one of the worst free throw shooting teams in the country. And like you mentioned, the only thing they really do well offensively is crash the offensive glass. And as strong as Houston is on the offensive glass, they are pretty middling, mediocre, whatever you want to call it, when it comes to defensive rebounding. So if I'm a USF fan trying to talk myself into how I think the Bulls are going to score enough points to stay in this one, that's the thing I'm probably circling. And then defense is definitely USF's better side of the ball. They're not great, but they're decent. They force a bunch of turnovers. That's definitely a strength versus strength matchup, as Houston has been excellent at ball control this year. And the other point I had is kind of like you said, the nicest thing you can say about them is that they've been mostly competitive. Only one of their losses this year has been by double digits, a 15-point loss to UAB back in November. And the two best teams that they've played have been Auburn and Memphis, and they had second-half leads against both of those teams before melting down the stretch against both of those teams also. But ultimately, if you just lost back-to-back home games to Temple and Wichita like USF did, coming to the play at the Fertitta Center against the number one team of the country, and that Cougar defense is probably not going to turn out super well for you.
Probably not. Dustin, I had one last note here. I was trying to look back and find the last time that U of H lost a game to USF. And I had memory hold this one. You and I were both physically present at Hoffman's Pavilion along with our good friend Ish of Barry Media for a Saturday afternoon affair during Kelvin Sampson's second season, where Jamal McMurray caught fire and went off for 30 points, that's and the right. Cougars lost 71-62 to USF, and it was just like, I remember that. I vaguely remember we were sitting in seats that were directly opposite of the U of H and USF benches, because you could essentially in those days pick your seat in the Hoffman's Pavilion, and just like, oh yeah, we lost that one. And in that stretch since then, the Cougars have won 11 straight since then. There have only been two games that have been decided by less than double digits, a 69-60 win in 2019. And I remember this one as well, a pretty nervy 62-58 win in early 2020 that I believe we both watched at your old apartment in Austin right after you moved in. The Cougars nearly gave that one away with their pretty young roster there. But, you know, not a basketball series, because this will be the last time the Cougars see USF. This is the one team that we're only going to see at home, with ECU being the one team we're only going to see on the road. But, yeah, probably not a basketball series I think either of us are sad to see end. I think, but we do both generally like the USF people we've come into contact with, and I think certainly hope at some point they have a men's basketball team that's in the same galaxy as their consistently excellent women's team, which we're going to talk a little bit about here later in the episode.
So Jamal McMurray, I remember transferring to SMU, and I looked it up while you.
Yeah, that's right.
While I was like, well, surely he beat Houston again. No, apparently it was 0-4 against Houston SMU. So he got that one win as a USF Bull, where he went off against the Cougs, and unfortunately that was it for his wins over SMU. No, definitely Jamal McMurray, a name I had not thought about in many moons. And then Houston's other game coming up is going to be at Tulane on Tuesday. This is a Green Wave team I was pretty high on coming into the year. I thought they had a chance to be Tulane's first NCAA tournament team since 1995, and just fourth NCAA tournament team all time for a program that's been playing basketball since before the NCAA tournament existed. They were a top 100 KenPom team last year for the first time since the year 2000, and then they returned to basically everybody, including a pair of high-scoring guards in Jalen Cook and Jalen Forbes, not to mention talented forward Kevin Cross. But their non-conference this year was definitely a disappointment. It was a disappointment in the fact that they didn't schedule a single game against a team that was from one of the top six conferences, and their only top 100 opponent this year, as of right now, is, and probably for the rest of the year, is number 60 Nevada Reno, who they lost to. And they also lost to teams outside the top 100 in Western Kentucky, Fordham, and George Mason. Their best non-conference win was over number 186 Buffalo, and then they opened AAC play with an 11-point loss at Cincinnati. But the good news is they are on a three-game winning streak since then, knocking off Memphis at home, unsurprisingly taking care of Tulsa, and then going up to Philadelphia and beating a Temple team that has home wins over Villanova, VCU, and Cincinnati on the year, and who had been 3-0 in AAC play until the Green Wave beat them. So definitely turning things around a little bit. Also, I think very noteworthy that Jalen Cook missed the first five games, missed five games, I should say, in non-conference play. He's back in action now and seems to be running at 100%. So I think that's obviously a huge thing, as he is a huge part of what they do over there. So, you know, I still don't know if I would call this a good Tulane team. They're definitely a team that will need to win the AAC tournament if they want to end that March Madness drought that I mentioned. And they have lost seven straight games to your Cougs, all by double digits, including an 0-5 record against Houston since Ron Hunter arrived. But you know, I think with this game being in New Orleans, I think they're a sneaky, dangerous team. I'm glad that this game doesn't come either before or after a tougher game for Houston, so there's no reason to think that the Cougs are going to have either the hangover effect or the look-ahead effect here. But I do think that, unlike several opponents in this conference, I think the Cougs will actually have to play reasonably well to win this one, Sam.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Had a pretty strong start in conference. Like you, was kind of surprised they didn't get a little more ambitious in non-conference play. The schedules they put together the last 2 years, which are pretty similar to this one, I get that. You have a fairly young team the last 2 years. The program that just hasn't won a lot much prior to you getting there. So I get that you want to build confidence. I get that you want to maybe stack the wins a little bit. But I think you certainly had a good enough team this year to maybe at least test yourself once or twice against a better opponent, the likes of which the Green Wave saw in their non-conference. But off to a pretty strong start in conference play, 3-1 against the conference at this moment, including a impressive 96-89 win over Memphis, the second year the Green Wave have beaten Penny Hardaway and the Tigers. In NOAA, they actually, I thought this was really impressive, they did it the night before the Cotton Bowl, where you'd imagine a pretty sizable chunk of the local Green Wave fan base was far away from campus in Dallas. But I would say I agree with you. I don't know if I'd call this a good team yet, but I think certainly Ron Hunter's best Tulane team now in his fourth year in Uptown. And I'm pretty confident that when it's all said and done, this will be the Green Wave's best KenPom team in the 21st century, and it'll be the best KenPom team this century for the second year in a row after finishing in the top 100 for the first time in ages last year. I think they've done a good job keeping their roster together, and I think it's because Hunter built the roster in a smart way in that he brought in a bunch of young transfers, but notably their transfers, guys who already use their free transfer at their from their first Division One stop. So that's not to say they couldn't get a second transfer approved, but it's not necessarily as easy to move around that you have guys and you have them pretty well committed to you for a 3-4 year stretch. Guys like Jalen Forbes and Jalen Cook, who started their careers at Alabama and LSU respectively, and Hunter has certainly done a much better job coaxing a good college level guard out of those two guys. And what his Hunter's teams do is pretty similar year in, year out. They're going to take a lot of fairly early in the clock shots. They're currently 21st in tempo right now. They're going to put a significant higher priority on getting back in transition for off of the missed shots versus crashing the offensive glass. It's kind of the mirror image approach than what you see the Cougars do. And I think defensively showing a pretty heavy amount of matchup zone. And they've also been quite good at getting their free throw line. I think that's something you always keep an eye on. This Cougar team, it's always been kind of a bugaboo for a team that's going to play the consistent brand of physical defense that this Cougar team does. But I think you've seen a Cougar team this year that's been better in that regard. You've faced some opponents that have already been quite good at getting to the free throw line, and I think have been able to kind of weather the storm against them. I think Jalen Cook's definitely the guy we're going to see do the most heavy lifting on the offensive end. Like you said, I think very critical they missed him for 5 games in non-conference play, inside the top 50 nationally in both possessions played and percentages of shots taken. I would say definitely more of a slasher than a guy who's going to bomb from deep. Jalen Cook is probably the Jalen Forbes is Cook's backcourt mate is probably more of the primary bomber from deep, is currently hitting just a hair under 38% from three-point range. I like Kevin Cross a lot. He's a real efficient front-court scorer. He's going to be pretty good at getting to the line, one of the better free-throw shooting big men the Cougs are going to see this year. And I think something that separates this specific Tulane team from the previous couple, I think, has been the more consistent emergence of guys like Sion James and Tylan Pope, guys who were rotation guys previously, but not really guys capable of ever taking over a game. And you saw James specifically do that when he dropped 30 on Memphis at home on New Year's Day. Again, worth reiterating, Tulane has not played the hardest schedule to this point. Only 3 top 100 KenPom teams. Talked about the win over Memphis. You mentioned the loss to Nevada Reno. Pretty convincing loss. Also on the road to Cincy. And none of those teams that I just mentioned are in the national top 50. So really next Tuesday will be Tulane's first time even seeing a team close to U of H's caliber. I always really kind of struggle to envision how a team like Tulane that just stylistically, it's not because they're bad rebounders per se, stylistically they choose not to grab very many offensive rebounds. I struggle to see how a team that makes that decision is going to find a path to beating the Cougars. I mean, some of the things Tulane does well, like I just mentioned, getting the free throw line, playing at a high tempo, not turning the ball over, I think those things match up well with U of H, but those offensive rebounds allow you, I think, some tiny margin of error against a Cougar team that's really good at stopping you from scoring at all levels. And you, to beat this team, are going to need a lot of second chances. The second chances that UCF was able to get themselves at times, the second chances that Alabama was able to get themselves at times. And I also think that Tulane matchup zone, which I think by its nature is going to give guys like Marcus Sasser, Tremont Mark, and Jairus Walker open looks, it's a dangerous strategy. I mean, just look at when these teams, you know, played 2 years ago in Houston. Marcus Sasser and Quentin Grimes combined to go 12 of 25 from deep. Cougs also shot above their season average from three when the Cougs played them in NOLA last year, another decisive Cougar win. So I think just some of the things Tulane is going to do stylistically, game in, game out, make this, I think, a hard hill to climb for them. But I would agree with what you said, kind of your final assessment, that this is certainly an opponent good enough that the Cougars cannot play a C-minus game against the Green Wave and not really feel the pressure and potentially drop this one on the road.
You mentioned the matchup zone, and I think there's two things that you kind of think about with that. Number one, what you kind of talked about, that it tends to give the other team a lot of semi-contested threes, and Houston has, I think, really grown in its team confidence, and they're shooting threes recently compared to where they were earlier in the season. And then also, when you play a zone, any kind of zone, it's a lot harder to match up on the glass quite often. And, Houston in the five games that they've played against Tulane under Ron Hunter, not only have they won all those five games, they've won all those five games while averaging a plus 12 rebounding margin per game in those five wins, which is kind of one of the effects of having a really, really strong rebounding team going up against a team that plays primarily zone. And I said it a minute ago, Houston tends to either dominate in terms of turnovers or on the glass. Tulane's done a fantastic job of taking care of the ball this year, so I don't know if the Cougs are going to be able to force 15 or 18 turnovers or anything like that. I'd be surprised if that happens, but this is a Tulane team that I think is really going to struggle once again to contain the Cougs rebounding-wise. Really intrigued by how the way that they go towards contact when they have the ball, though, Tulane. You mentioned how often they get to the line, which obviously a good strategy when you're the number three free throw shooting team in the country at a ludicrous 81.4%. I think very funny going from one of the worst free throw shooting teams to one of the best free throw shooting teams in the country in back-to-back games. But going towards that contact offensively has also meant that Tulane has gotten a ton of their shots blocked this year. They are one of the top 10, or I guess I probably should say bottom 10 teams in the country at getting their shots blocked the most often. And guess which team leads the country in blocking opponent shots on defense? That Ayo. Would be your Houston Cougars. So definitely a fascinating matchup there in terms of, you know, is Tulane able to get shots off against Houston, and is, you know, Houston able to block those shots without fouling? And then my final point, another interesting clash here. Houston plays one of the slower paces in the country, and we've talked about it before. Some of that has to do with the fact that Houston has longer offensive possessions because of the offensive rebounds, and that extends possessions and makes there be fewer possessions per game. But also Houston just often isn't in a big hurry offensively. They have confidence in their ability to move the ball and get good shots late in the shot clock. And, you know, and then defensively, Houston is so difficult to get a good look against that opponents often end up taking 20-plus seconds before finally kind of taking a desperation shot late in the shot clock, which leads to Houston having one of the lowest numbers of possessions per game. Tulane had been pretty much square in the middle nationally in terms of pace under Ron Hunter, but have really ratcheted it up this year. They are in the top 15 now in the country in terms of shortest offensive possessions and most possessions per game, which again, part of that, but definitely not all of that, has to do with the fact that they don't grab very many offensive rebounds. But what this all adds up to is Tulane averages over 72 possessions per game. Houston's highest number of possessions in any single game this year was 72 against Alabama. That's the only time that they've broken 70. Houston averages 63.5 possessions per game. Tulane's lowest single game total this year is 66. So it's kind of a something's got to give game here in terms of you know, what we're seeing, and very intrigued just to see if Tulane's, you know, try to get a good quick shot right away, you know, how that goes up against a, you know, facing a Houston defense that is very good at forcing you to take lots of time to get a contested shot.
And, you know, this is always a Cougar team that's run at a slower pace, but we've seen at times against an opponent that really wants to push tempo, this Cougar team just absolutely catching fire and putting up some absurd offensive stats. So I'm curious whether we see the Cougars say, you know what, yeah, I think we'll play with Tulane's pace, or just eventually the Cougars, I think, do what they did to everyone this year, save for Alabama, and just impose their will and impose kind of the pace that this team's more comfortable playing at.
All right, and then smoothly transitioning to Houston also playing Tulane in basketball, but on the women's side, we want to go and talk about the Cougar women's team, which opened last week with a big win at Tulane, 59-56 final score. Really, really exciting win for the Cougs. You know, we talked about in the preview how, you know, all the AAC is down this year. This Tulane squad looked like one of the better non-USF teams in the conference, and after that exciting win for Houston to beat SMU to open conference play, following it up with a road win in New Orleans, I thought was a real statement for this program that, you know, despite the ugly non-conference record, this team is capable of turning things around and being competitive, you know, right at the top of the American Athletic Conference. And one of the things that excited me was seeing in the Tulane game, seeing Houston specifically avoid one of the major pitfalls that they've had this year, which is, you know, playing well in one or two quarters and then absolutely laying an egg in one or two other quarters, so such that it kind of undoes your all of your hard work. But against Tulane, you know, Houston trailed by two after the first quarter. They had their one big quarter in the second quarter, outscoring Tulane 19-10 to take a 7-point halftime lead. And then from there, they were able to hold on to this one by not having a bad quarter. They played a dead even third quarter. They let Tulane cut into the lead a little bit in the closing minutes in the fourth quarter, but never let them catch all the way back up. Held on to win by three. So really strong team win, and you got to start out by talking about Tierra Young, who continues her incredibly impressive run of play. She had 19 points on 6 of 10 shooting off the bench to go with her 9 rebounds. Fourth straight game she had been in double figures. She's now averaging better than 13 points a game off the bench, second on the team only to Layla Blair. So really impressive individual performance by Tierra Young to pace the Houston offense in a game when they still, you know, only scored 59 points. So it was definitely more of a defensive win than an offensive one. They needed those points from Tierra Young for sure. But just overall have to be really impressed with the Cougs for picking up a key road win.
Yeah, if you're going to pick a nit, maybe a bit closer than comfortable at the end, but getting your first road win of the season by outlasting a team that we thought would be one of the better ones of the conference, I think, really fantastic. Was certainly in the territory of a game where any margin of win would have been an acceptable one. And whilst it was a low scoring affair, the Cougs got the lead at the beginning of the second quarter and never relinquished it for the last three quarters. I thought kind of funny, the game never tied and only had one lead change, which was U of H taking the lead in the early second there. And I thought really impressive stuff considering that this team had previously, certainly in non-conference, struggled closing out games, struggled holding on to leads, and that you were able to pull out this one against a team that we thought might be one of the tougher ones in the conference, with also, I think very importantly, Layla Blair having maybe her worst offensive game of the season, being in foul trouble and only playing, I think, 22 minutes, and that you're able to win this one against a good team. I think it speaks to maybe the depth you have in this team, and it certainly speaks to the resolve. And you got the help from a number of different places, with Blair not having her best game. You mentioned Tierra Young returning to her home state, leading the Cougars with 19 points, 19 boards. She has been quite good for the Cougs off the bench this season. In a season where at the team level, the offense has been kind of come or go, I think she's been pretty consistently excellent in that area. Tatiana Hill, 14 points, 9 boards, and 3 steals. Really the combined effort from Hill and Bria Patterson in the front court. The two of them had 8 offensive boards. Really good. Not a game for beautiful, free-flowing offensive play. I mean, you saw these two teams combine for 50 turnovers. Neither team ultimately reached 60 points. But I think it bears repeating, was definitely a game we knew coming in would be a low-scoring affair, and that a game where any win would be a good win. So I think, obviously, first and foremost, a big kudos to the ladies for finding a way to win when your best offensive player isn't at her best, and to Seattle road win when you've really, really struggled away from home this year. I don't know if this is a game the team would have been able to see out a month or two ago, so I think definitely shows growth from this group.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about it, but how about, you know, how big is it to get a win in a game where you're on the road and your best player, Layla Blair, only scores 2 points? Very impressive performance by the Cougs. Tatiana Hill, another great game, like you mentioned, narrowly misses the double-double, 14 points on 7-9 shooting with 9 boards. But yeah, ultimately just another really strong defensive performance. Their strong start to conference play has been primarily defense-driven. They held Tulane under 37% shooting while only sending them to the line 14 times. That's often been a sore spot for the Cougs, so love everything about the win other than, you know, maybe he could have been a little bit more efficient offensively. But, oh boy, if you want to see a strong defensive performance, Sam, where Houston also plays well offensively, they kind of got that in their very next game. As just this evening, just moments before we started recording this podcast, Houston finishes throttling UCF by an 80-42 final score. You know, I already had in my notes calling the Tulane game a statement win because it was just a road win against a good team, but maybe I should have held off on using that descriptor because there are statement wins, and then there are statement wins, and beating a team that has beaten you 12 straight times by 38 points is a statement win of an entirely other caliber. My goodness. Houston jumps out to a 10-0 lead to start the game, never looks back, pushes the lead to 15 by the end of the first quarter, make it 24 by halftime, make it 35 by the end of the third quarter, and then ends up with a 38-point victory. Obviously just a all-around team victory with tons of contributors when you win by that kind of margin. But, you know, if you want to single out an individual player, Bria Patterson was a star, 18 points and 8-9 shooting this one. She's someone that I thought we were going to highlight more this year than we have, hadn't really taken the step forward that I thought she was poised for heading into the season. So just love seeing her go off like that and have a big game. But man, talk about a cathartic win to beat UCF by 38 points, Sam.
Yeah, and we talked about when we previewed this game. This is not the UCF team of last year and the year before that was going to compete for the conference title, but when you've lost that many times in a row to one opponent, I'm not sure that really matters so much. I think it was just kind of this mental hurdle this team had to get over to win, and I thought really cool that you finally broke through after you know, a long losing streak that included a number of close, painful losses within to win and for it to not be in doubt after less than a quarter of basketball. Yeah, I know after the first quarter, I know a 15-point lead can be squandered over the course of three quarters, but if you watch this one, which I did while cooking what I hope was a delicious dinner for my significant other, it never really felt like the Cougars were ever going to be really troubled in this one. And that kind of dominance from start to finish, I'm not sure it was something we, you know, a month or two ago watching this team, really thought the Cougars were going to be capable of doing against anyone in conference play, even the dregs of the league, of which I'm not sure we knew, you know, UCF was going to be or not. I think just how the Cougars did it, very dominant. And I think also kind of like the Tulane game, I think Layla Blair gave you a bit more. She had 7 points. And I think certainly want to clarify that Layla Blair is always going to give you something, even when the shots aren't falling, that she's going to be a positive contributor. So I'm not trying to single out Layla Blair here. I'm trying to point out that this team doesn't need Layla Blair to be making everything she throws up to dominate a conference opponent from start to finish. I think it's really impressive and maybe not necessarily something we had enough faith in this team to do a month or so ago, because quite frankly, the on-court results, I don't think merited that faith. And just really no matter who it's against in conference to have this comprehensive of a win. I thought this was my favorite stat, Dustin, that obviously, you know, game you score 80 points, you shoot pretty well. The Cougars shot a very good percentage for the first, second, and third quarters. The Cougs scored 80 points this one, Dustin, despite shooting terribly in the fourth quarter. I remember because this was enough of a blowout that I stopped watching live and I ate my dinner and walked my dogs. But I checked in on the game's box score at one point, and the Cougars were on like a 4-minute drought scoring, and we're still up by well into the 30s. That's how dominant the defensive effort was as well. Just everything clicking, and I think really awesome to see this team against this opponent who they've struggled with for so many years to break that, to get the win, and to improve to 3-0 in conference play. Again, I know UCF certainly won't be among this conference's best teams, but again, I don't think we thought this team could be anyone by 38 a month or so ago.
Yeah, I think to kind of piggyback on the point you're talking about Layla Blair, though, I think it's key for this team to realize that she doesn't have to shoot, you know, 15, 20 shots a game for Houston to be successful, because we saw a lot of that early on in the year. You know, 20 shots against New Mexico, 23 against Florida State, you know, 19 against Florida, 18 against Washington State, and then coming to conference play, 10 against SMU, 6 against Tulane, 9 against UCF. And yeah, part of that against Tulane and UCF is not playing a ton of minutes because of, you know, I think foul trouble in the one instance, and actually she had 4 fouls in both of those games, so maybe some foul trouble in both of those games. But, you know, she can impact the game another way. She had, you know, 4, 4, and 3 assists in those games. She had, you know, 2 steals each of those games. You know, she's still someone who's going to be part of the opposition scouting report on offense such that she can, you know, help her teammates in this one. And they don't need her to shoot a ton of shots and be the leading scorer in every game. You know, it was Bria Patterson in this one. Cameron Jones, Tatiana Hill, and Britt Onyeje also scored in double figures in this one as well. You know, really encouragingly, Houston, who has struggled just mightily with a 3-ball this year, had a 7 of 17 team performance from beyond the arc. It's certainly chicken soup for the soul there. So really like what Houston was doing offensively in this one in terms of spreading the ball around. But man, you have to also just talk about what a dominant defensive performance it was, holding UCF to under 30% shooting, just 2 of 13 from beyond the arc. Really exciting to see this team play defense like that while also having their best offensive game of the year. And that's why, like you mentioned, Houston can shoot 4 of 20 as a team in the fourth quarter and not only hold on to their lead, but actually extend the lead. They actually beat UCF 10-7 in the fourth quarter while they were doing that, because UCF shot 2 of 12 from the field in the fourth quarter. So yeah, just over the moon, excited about what a just dominant and comprehensive victory that was for Houston to get to 3-0. It took them 13 games to get to 3 wins in non-conference play. It took them 3 games to get to 3 wins in conference play. Clearly, this is a team that seems to have turned the corner, and really excited to see in a pretty wide-open American Athletic Conference how that ends up shaking out the rest of the year.
Only thing I can add is just that it's progress that Layla Blair and Tierra Young, I would say certainly your best 2 offensive players, can combine for 13 points and you could still so comprehensively beat a conference opponent. It's a sign of progress. It's a sign of a team that isn't just winning games. It's winning games in a way that could be sustained, because Layla Blair and Tierra Young aren't going to shoot this bad most nights. You're going to get better offensive contributions from those two that you can get as little on the offensive end from them and still win like this, I think it bodes well for conference play. Hopefully I'm not sticking my foot in my mouth there, but I think I'm feeling some genuine optimism after tonight's win.
All right, then the Cougs will be next back in action on Saturday when they'll be up at Tulsa. And I feel like we keep saying this about every opponent that Houston has in the American Athletic Conference, but it's a Tulsa team that has a pretty strong overall record, but largely on the basis of not having played the best strength of schedule. Tulsa is 13-3 overall. That includes a 3-0 start to conference play. But like I said, not really any marquee wins in the non-conference, and their three conference wins are over East Carolina, Wichita, and UCF, who I would say at this point none of them look like top half of the AAC teams. I think an interesting, intriguing game. I think Houston's gonna be one of the tougher games that that Tulsa has had this year. In terms of interesting players, forward Tamira Poindexter was the conference freshman of the year a year ago. She's building on that this year, averaging better than 15 points and 6 rebounds per game. Definitely one to watch out for. And then manages a team, they shoot a ton of threes. This is incredible. This was so close to being absolutely perfect in a way that would have also blown my mind, and I also probably would have had to double check it. As on the year, Tulsa has taken exactly 1,000 field goal attempts, and 501 of them have been 3-point shots. So they're going to take, I'm going to say, slightly, very, very slightly over half of their shots, maybe from beyond the arc. They've literally got one bench rotation player who doesn't really shoot the three. Every other single player who's going to see the court for Tulsa will absolutely let it fly from deep if they get an open look. So, interesting matchup for Houston in terms of how you deal with a team with that many three-point shooters. And like I said, a very interesting matchup in terms of getting a 13-3 Tulsa team on the road and having a chance to continue your unbeaten start to conference play.
If you'll recall, last year when these two teams faced off, it was kind of weird. Tulsa was the only team that the Cougars swept the season series against, and just given the rough January that the Cougars had last year, even though Tulsa was definitely one of the more improved teams in the league last year under first-year head coach Angie Nelp, they're 13-3, like you said, but kind of peel back the layers of the onion at 13-3. Not a lot of really strong opponents among those 13 wins. They're three conference wins so far, not necessarily against the best teams in the league or teams that project to be among the best teams in this league, though admittedly as of this morning they're about 30 spots higher in the net than the Cougars. They have Tamira Poindexter, you mentioned, the returning AAC freshman of the year, having a pretty strong sophomore year, not the most efficient scorer, but she's gonna challenge you and actually, you know, take shots from deep like not maybe the average forward you're gonna see. Will, I think this is going to really test the Cougars' perimeter defense on the whole. Maya Mayberry, worth noting as well, shooting an impressive 40% on threes despite being very much a volume shooter herself. Also got a note, super senior Maddie Biddle and sophomore Delaney Crawford have also shot it quite well from deep this year. Going to test your perimeter defense, but I don't know if that's the worst news. I feel like perimeter defense is actually something this Cougar team has done quite well this year. I think it's not coincidental last year's group did better against Tulsa than they did against the average AAC opponent, but I'm also not going to pretend I'm wildly confident about a Cougar team that just won their first road game about a week ago playing an opponent that's won a good chunk of their home games at the Reynolds Center. I mean, it would be a very nice win to keep building momentum because, as we'll get to next Wednesday, you have a pretty tough home test in the conference slate coming.
Ooh, are we getting to that? Because I was under the impression our next episode is going to be Tuesday, so I do not have any notes on Wednesday.
That's right, so that's right, that's
if you,
right.
If you want to talk about that, I mean, by the time the next episode drops, it'll be probably just a few hours away from that game. So if you want to talk about that real quick, I think it is worth mentioning, because like you said, Houston, next Wednesday going up against South Florida, the team that looks... I would say at this point, like they're in a tier by themselves in terms of the American Athletic Conference.
Yeah, certainly. As I think has been usual in kind of this post-UConn era, the team that's been, I think, the most consistent class of the league under longtime head coach Jose Fernandez has some really sparkling non-conference wins. Note, we will not be picking apart USF's non-conference because they played a lot of very good opponents, even beat a couple of them. They beat a top 25 Arkansas team, lost in overtime to a top 5 Ohio State team, beat a certain burnt orange school in Austin on their home court. A real veteran team. Fernandez returns a couple of multi-time all-conference players. Elena Chineka, Dulcie Fancom-Menjadeu. Also brought in a couple of impact first-year players. Carla Brito, who's started every one of their games, a freshman, as well as Florida State transfer Sammy Puisis, who's really been, I think, I would say probably the best three-point shooter among American Conference guards. The Bulls certainly aren't going to shoot it from deep nearly as much as the team we're going to see before that, Tulsa, but Puisa certainly is going to test the Cougars' perimeter defense and will really make this team pay if she gets open looks. But I think what's scariest about the Bulls, among, I would say, many potential scary things, is how good they've been defensively, how good they are on the glass. And for all the positives and all the good vibes about how the Cougars have played after a pretty rough non-conference, I don't know. I have a hard time really envisioning how the Cougs score enough points to, you know, beat the Bulls or keep the Bulls off the glass enough to keep this game close when the Bulls do miss their shots. And I think that kind of bore itself out last year when these teams played three times and USF won all those games of to varying degrees of convincing. I think it's kind of the flip side when we talk about Cougar men's basketball and we kind of look at an opponent and say, okay, but how can they score enough points to win this game? I kind of look at the Cougars and I look at USF and I believe this is a Cougar team playing its best basketball this year, but I struggle to see how they score enough points to win this one. It's not an opponent that U of H has never beat. U of H has gotten some wins against good Jose Fernandez USF teams, but I do struggle to see how this team scores enough points to win this game, but hope I'm wrong, because that would be quite the signature win for the Cougars to get. Like you said, very much a team in a class of its own right now in the American.
Alrighty, so I think let's go ahead and jump in, Sam, to some Cougar football recruiting news. Definitely some interesting additions to the Cougs, both this past weekend and then a trio of transfers today. I guess I can still say today. It's still Tuesday, late night here. But yeah, starting with the high school recruit of the bunch, Michael Harrison Pilot, committing to Cougar football on Saturday. Listed as an athlete on recruiting websites as he's played both wide receiver and safety in high school, but everything I've seen indicates that Houston intends to use him as a receiver, and Pilot himself talked about seeing what U of H did with Tank Dell and having that factor into his decision. And as we mentioned last week when we talked about him, you know, his final two schools widely reported to be Houston and TCU, but he had copious other offers. His official final five that he, you know, picked the hat from included those two schools plus UT Austin, Oklahoma, and Cal Berkeley. His U of H legacy, you may remember his dad, Chris Pilot, playing linebacker and special teams for the Cougs back in the early 2000s, including on the playing every game in the 2006 Conference USA championship season. Mother Jennifer was a cheerleader at U of H back in the day. And yeah, talked about what a coup it would be. And it is. It's a big deal for the Cougs. Michael Harrison Pilot becomes the fourth highest rated recruit to commit to Houston in the recruiting service era, which is, you know, roughly since the beginning of the century, trailing only Ed Oliver, Deontay Greenberry, and Trendavian Dixon, who never actually made it to campus. And interestingly, the next two highest rated recruits to pick Houston, Matthew Golden, who obviously had an impressive season this year at wide receiver, and Jonah Wilson, another wide receiver who is committed to Houston for next year. So with all three of those youngsters on the roster, plus guys like Sammy Brown and Joseph Manjack returning for Houston, that wide receiver room looked absolutely stacked already before Tuesday. And spoiler alert, MHP not going to be the last or even the second to last receiver that Houston added to their 2023 roster this week. But before we get to those, definitely worth taking a minute to be excited about, you know, what a big deal landing Michael Harrison Pilot could turn out to be.
Yeah, I think in breaking down his commitment, he talked a fair amount about his relationship with Cougar receiver coach Dakeel Shorts. Also, you mentioned Tank Dell, like you said, also talked about how Matthew Golden got very much involved in the offense his first year on campus. We talked about that. That's not just good for what you're doing on the field, but was very much a showing recruits, say, hey, this four-star came here, and we immediately got him on the field making plays and getting recognition. He didn't have to redshirt here. He immediately was able to get on the field and be a big part of the offense. Definitely makes me feel a little bit old that we are now, Dustin, we have been Cougar fans long enough that you and I saw Chris Pilot's last 2 years in college, and now we are talking on our podcast, lo these 15, 16 years later, about Chris Pilot's son being a highly sought-out four-star recruit who's committing to the Cougars. Fun trivia question. Chris was actually the last U of H player not named Case Keem to wear the number 7, as he had a couple years of seniority on our legendary quarterback. And I thought it was really cool. MHP talked in his commitment about the Cougar legacy, finishing what his dad started. And quick plug. We'll certainly have a detailed breakdown of MHP's commitment. We're going to do a special premium pod here in the not too distant future on all the Cougar signees and transfers, what have you. But I'll say here, this is the kind of recruit that you needed to see U of H get with the Big 12 recruiting bump. You know, being in the Big 12 doesn't necessarily put you in the stratosphere of recruiting the five-star or high four-star guys, you still have to be another echelon of program consistently in terms of resources, fan support, and really consistent on-field results, or I guess in the case of one school, wear burnt orange and have the state's name on the front of your jersey. But this is the kind of guy with a recruiting profile you need to be competing for. I mean, just looking now at the class with Harrison Pilot committed, this class is very comparable to what the non-OU, TCU, and Cal College teams in the Big 12 are doing right now, which is good, is what you want to be seeing. And you could say what you will, and we've certainly said plenty about the disappointing 2022 on-field product, but the staff has recruited absolutely every bit like you'd want them to recruit moving into a much tougher league. That area of the program certainly looks like everything you want it to be. I think now you just got to see the on-field results maybe catch up a little bit against a much tougher group of opponents.
Yeah, not only does this, you know, I think kind of indicate that the Big 12 recruiting bump is happening, but I think this is a recruit you probably don't land if you're not headed to the Big 12 next year, as much as I'm sure Michael Harrison Pilot is excited about being a U of H legacy and you know, coming back to play at the school where his father played. It's a lot easier to make that decision when you're deciding between two Big 12 teams as opposed to, you know, deciding between a team that just played for a national championship and between a team that's playing in the American Athletic Conference next year. So very excited. That's why you know, one of the reasons why you are so excited about the Big 12 move is getting to see Houston land more elite recruits. You know, there's the occasional Ed Oliver that'll come play for Houston in the American, obviously. But by and large, you don't land recruits of this caliber playing in a conference that is that caliber. So and as previously mentioned, MHP not the only wide receiver joining Houston this week, as the Cougs also nabbed a pair of receivers out of the transfer portal on Tuesday in Joshua Cobbs of Wyoming and Stephon Johnson Jr. of Oklahoma State. Starting with Cobbs, was a starter each of the past two seasons for the Cowboys, including leading the team this year in catches and yards with 35 catches for 407 yards. Those numbers probably don't jump out at you, but this is a Wyoming team that didn't throw the ball very much, and with his size, he's listed at 6'4", 204 pounds, and with that kind of production, even in a very much run-first offense, he received a ton of interest in the portal, had offers from Texas A&M, Ole Miss, Cincinnati, West Virginia, Arizona State, and Louisville, among others. Also took an official visit to Oregon. So excited to see a big-bodied receiver that's already shown some college ability, Sam, and who has a couple of years of eligibility remaining.
Yeah, a guy with a significant amount of divisional experience, and I think important context to his numbers at Wyoming. I mean, leading receiver this year, but the numbers don't scream at you, but this was also an offense that didn't even come close to throwing for 200 yards per game. So I think it's a pretty big, heavy bit of context there. And frankly, that he was able to do what he did in an offense that seemed actively hostile as any non-service academy team is to throwing the ball. Wyoming was that, and yet he still put up pretty decent numbers. And like you mentioned, had a bunch of schools that were really, really interested in him. I think kind of a cool connection back to Texas, probably a commitment you don't get if you don't have Mike Jinks on staff, Cougars running backs coach, a legendary San Antonio high school coach before being a college assistant, was briefly the head coach at Bowling Green, is now going to be entering his second season as the running backs coach. A very, very, very well-connected guy in the San Antonio area and among the Texas high school football community on the whole. So really nice get to bring him back to the Lone Star State and add him to a receiver group that we get more excited about almost by the hour.
And that already seemed like, excited to add a player of that caliber, but you figure maybe wide receiver wasn't the biggest position of need. And then on top of that, you add Stephon Johnson Jr., who was a true freshman for Oklahoma State last year, caught 17 passes for 293 yards, goes by Boogie. Very sought after recruit out of high school, committed to the Cowboys over a huge list of P5 offers that included, but was not limited to, Oregon, USC, Penn State, Utah, and Ole Miss. And, you know, we mentioned it on Twitter today, but this is someone that Oklahoma State fans were not happy to lose. There's a lot of drama going on around that program this offseason, a lot of outgoing transfers that have fans very worried. You know, this was by no means a going to Houston because he wouldn't have seen the field at Oklahoma State situation. If anything, at this point, it looks a lot more likely he would have had an easier time getting on the field up in Stillwater than he's going to have at Houston with the insane
receiver room transfer out, too. Yeah.
So, really, really exciting ad for Dana Holgorsen and staff, and the kind of player that I think has just a ton of long-term potential. And even if you go, man, he just adds to an already crowded receiver group. If you get a player of that caliber and have a chance to bring him in, I think you got to do it.
Yeah, played a big role on this year's team, a team that the offense really kind of got off the tracks, especially as quarterback Spencer Sanders got hurt in the middle of the season. So maybe not as extreme as Wyoming and Mr. Cobbs they just got done talking about, but not an offense that was very receiver friendly, and maybe part of why Boogie Johnson is going to be plying his trade at the University of Houston instead of Oklahoma State. Had an 84-yard touchdown reception in the Cowboys bowl game against Wisconsin as well. Really exciting guy, and that I think he looked at this team and certainly knows who's on the roster, certainly knows what's going to be in that receiver room, and still thought that he could get on the field for this team. That's really exciting. There's so many guys in this receiver group. I mean, obviously, you have someone who's a Big 12 starter in Donovan Smith, Lucas Coley, who a lot of people are excited about. So you don't necessarily know for sure who's going to be the quarterback there, but it certainly makes Donovan Smith or Lucas Coley's life a lot easier to have a group that's this deep, this talented, this exciting, and to have nearly all of those key guys having multiple years of eligibility left, a lot of them having three or four at the college level.
And then Houston's other transfer portal addition from Tuesday was Texas A&M linebacker Ish Harris. Harris was a four-star recruit out of the class of 2022 out of Pilot Point, just north of Dallas. Chose the Aggies out of high school over his other finalists, Oklahoma, UT Austin, Michigan, and Miami. Harris didn't see any action this year as a true freshman, which means he's coming to Houston with the full 4 years of eligibility remaining. And while you may be mildly concerned about taking a transfer who wasn't able to play for a pretty bad team, it is worth noting that, the Aggies were actually pretty good defensively. Their 5-7 record this year had very much to do with how miserably bad they were offensively. And, I went from A to D, that was quick. And B, he was a true freshman, and, true freshmen quite often don't play at SEC programs. So, I'd be a little surprised, Sam, I think, if he ends up winning a starting job based on the resume he comes in with. But I also think the Cougs could certainly stand to add some depth at the linebacker position, and Harris certainly qualifies as someone that you could see playing a big role down the road at some point.
And someone like Boogie Johnson had a lot of really big program interest in him, Oklahoma, Baylor, just to name a couple of the teams that were interested in his service outside of, obviously, the Aggies. And you kind of treat a guy who only has like one redshirt year in college and was part of the last recruiting cycle, you almost treat it like it's another high school signing, kind of. You just look at him and you're like, okay, well, you didn't do anything at A&M, but how would I feel about Ish Harris if Ish Harris was committing to us just as a high school recruit? Would be pretty exciting. Would be very, very much thinking this guy could be a defensive piece worth building around, even if it's not necessarily in 2023, I wouldn't be surprised if he's on the depth chart at some point this year, maybe playing some special teams as well.
All right, and then moving right along, first appearance of what is going to be a recurring segment or bit in the podcast going forward, as we are continuing to find new ways to thank our Patreon supporters. We are going to have each episode, we're going to have our podcast patron question of the week, where we solicit questions from our podcast patrons and then answer them here on the podcast for everybody's benefit. So solicited a couple of those questions. We're going to use one of them this week, and we'll certainly use some other questions going forward and try to have one of those every episode going forward. So our podcast patron question of the week this week comes from Daniel. Daniel, thanks for your support of the Scott and Holman podcast. Daniel asks, the Cliff Kingsbury NFL firing has me thinking about our offensive coordinator position. In general, do you think we can get a quality OC in here that Dana can give the keys to and just say go, like Kendall Briles was with Major, or is that not a realistic expectation under this regime? Sam, what say you?
I think you kind of have to parse this between can and will. Do I think U of H as a Big 12 program that's, I think, decently resourced? I think you're going from being a very, very well-resourced Group of Five program to being probably somewhere middle, lower middle class of the Big 12. But I absolutely think if Dana just decided, you know what, I like Shannon Dawson, but I don't know if I've been super thrilled with the results the past two seasons, and I really want to get a young guy in here who I can truly, because he's talked about it. He is tired of calling plays. He's, I think, found it very difficult to manage that part of his job and also be the head coach he wants to be. And for that, I do applaud him. I do applaud that, even though I think this is a guy with a lot of good years of play calling under his belt, that he realized that maybe he can't effectively wear both hats. And I think you're seeing that with a lot of coaches who are very much involved with offense or defense. I think he absolutely could with what U of H is and what U of H can offer an assistant, certainly one that maybe Dana wants to bring in, I think you could get a really quality offensive mind. But I also don't know if, one, Dana's bosses have the leverage over him to really say, hey, you need to make this change, at least right at this moment. I just don't think he wants to. I really don't think, unless the seat gets very, very warm under him and we get a lot closer to what's realistic buyout territory, that we're going to see him bring in a guy who has maybe a bit more leeway, a bit more, what's the word I'm looking for? A bit more of an ability to have a control over the offense than perhaps Dana allows his current offensive staff. I think you can find that guy, and he has in the past. His last 2 years at West Virginia, Jake Spavital, the recent former Texas State head coach, I think recently just got hired at Cal to run their offense. He very much let Jake Spavital run that offense with pretty good results when Will Grier was healthy there. So I think he's been willing to do that before, but nothing in these 4 years at Houston, and certainly the last year or two, where he seems to have maybe decided to stop calling plays, but seems no less interested in keeping Shannon Dawson around. So can it happen? Yes. Will it happen in the immediate future? I have a really hard time seeing it.
Yeah, I was going to say, heading into next year, no, I don't see that happening.
Certainly not next year.
I think one of the reasons for that is the fact that, you know, Houston's offense was pretty solid this year. So Houston's problems were largely defensive, not offensive. So I don't see there being a huge impetus to force that change to happen. And kind of like you were talking about, you know, Dana likes doing things Dana's way. Does not like being told what to do or how to run his program. Not, I guess, that any college football coach really likes being told how to run their program. But, you know, I think if your goal is to see Dana hand the keys to the offense over to an OC and just kind of let them run wild a little bit, I think there is a realistic path to that happening. And I think that path is Houston getting its butt kicked in the Big 12 with a struggling offense next year, which with a, you know, younger, you know, new quarterback, seems within the realm of possibility. You know, I think if that happens, Dana might still have too much time and money left on his contract for the school to get rid of him outright. But I think it's possible that the administration at that point will be irritated and impatient enough that maybe they'll be able to kind of force some changes on Dana. So, you know, if you are hoping to see the offense primarily run by an offensive mind where, you know, the primary offensive kind of mind running things is not Dana Holgorsen, my gut says that the most likely way that happens the next time that will be the case is because Dana Holgorsen is no longer the head coach of the University of Houston. But I think it's entirely possible heading into 2024 that, you know, Dana and or the U of H administration gets to the point where they realize that maybe things need to, you know, play out a little bit differently. All right. Well, thank you again, Daniel. And let's move right along. We got a couple sports still to talk about. We've only talked about 3 of the 6 we said we were going to talk about, and we are, good Lord, are we over an hour, like an hour and a half into this episode? My goodness.
A meaty podcast, certainly.
Meaty, to say the least. We've got an entire track and field season preview to talk about here, so let's get right into it. Indoor track and field season begins on Friday with Houston hosting the Leonard Hilton Memorial Invitational, and the times, they are a-changing for Houston Cougar track and field. This will be the first year since, I'm pretty sure it was like 1879, that the Cougs will not be led by Leroy Burrell, who left in the offseason for Auburn, as you probably know by now. Houston continues to be under the leadership of Carl Lewis, now the head coach, as well as longtime Cougs Will Blackburn, now the director of track and field, and associate coach Kyle Telez. Houston also added Sandra Glover as an assistant coach this offseason. She was a standout hurdler for the Cougs back in the early 90s, went on to represent the U.S. in the 2000 Summer Olympics, won the 400 hurdles at U.S. Outdoor Track and Field Championships 4 straight years from 1999 to 2002, so very accomplished athlete and well-respected enough as now as a coach that back in August, USA Track and Field selected her as the women's sprints and hurdles coach for the North American, Central American, and Caribbean Championships. NACAC? N-A-C-A-C? I don't know. So even with Burrell no longer around, Sam NACAC, however, I'm open to pronunciations, but either way, with Leroy Burrell no longer around, Sam, this still looks like a very impressive coaching staff, and one that you know, I think you have a lot of confidence in to you know, put out a solid product every year.
Yeah, a lot of quality, and also obviously the two people at the top, Will Blackburn and Carl Lewis. Will Blackburn, I think basically his entire coaching career since he was a Cougar athlete, being involved in the Cougar track and field program, coaching a very successful group with the throwers as well, both on the men's and women's side. I think I think Carl Lewis's resume kind of speaks for itself. Certainly as an Olympian, as a sprinter, his time at the University of Houston as well. But I think that should also overshadow the fact that he's overseen a very successful era of sprinting for the Cougs. I would say arguably in the last few years here, the most consistently successful era since him and Leroy were running for the team. I think track eligibility is always going to be tricky. I think we're going to see a lot more of the name athletes for the outdoor season, but I think, like you're going to talk about, still plenty to watch the indoor season. And still, I think one of the cool things about the indoor season is for the first year athletes, for the athletes coming in the program that we haven't seen compete for the Cougars, to see, okay, maybe she's going to be a standout in this event, or maybe, ooh, this guy is going to be the next kind of heir apparent to, you know, being the elite sprinter in the program. So really, really excited to see who comes out there on Friday at the Leonard Hilt Memorial Invitational.
Yeah, it's also a it's a transition time with the coaching staff, but it's also a transition time for the program with, you know, obviously this being Houston's final year in the American before heading to the Big 12, and it's a transition time because the Cougs, you know, have taken a small step back from the level that they were at a couple of years ago, where, you know, the men's team was in the conversation in the final three for team national championships. Obviously, they haven't quite gotten to that level the last couple of years. So, like I said, expect this coaching staff to do a very strong job. But, you know, there's levels of being a very strong program that are, you know, that there are competing for national championship levels, and that there are, you know, you can still be solid and not be quite at that level. So, yeah, I think this is a very big year in terms of figuring out what Houston's, you know, early expectations are heading into the Big 12 for next year. And then in terms of looking at the names to watch here, you know, on the men's side, we'll start with the men's side. And obviously you got to start with Sean Maswangani, number one, threat to win the national championship in you know, any sprinting event. You know, I'm also curious to see if this is the year he kind of has a breakout year in the long jump. I know Carl Lewis has been very effusive in the past about what he thinks Sean's potential is in that event, but far from the only sprinter to be excited about for the Cougs. Edward Sumlow IV is also back, qualified for outdoor championships in the 100 and 200 meters last year. In fact, Houston's entire 4x1 relay of Maswangani, Sumler, and then Jordan Booker and Dylan Brown, which finished third at NCAA championships, does return. And on top of that, you get Christian Hamberlin, another impressive sprinter, still on the roster. Aaron Bell, a freshman last year, was extremely impressive sprinter as a high schooler, only competed in one event last year. I think if he's fully healthy, I'm really curious to see what he is able to do with this level. And then you added a freshman this year in Jaden Brown out of Pennsylvania, who I think is one to watch as well in the sprints, put up some really impressive times as a high school senior last year, won the state title in the 100 and 200 as both a junior and then again as a senior, and then added a state title in the 200 as a senior as well. So as usual, you kind of expect it every year, Sam, but continues to be the case that, you know, just no shortage of sprinting talent for this Cougar team, especially on the men's side.
I'm glad you mentioned Aaron Bell specifically, because he was someone I think we were pretty excited about going into last year, and just wasn't healthy. I think only competed at AAC Outdoors when it was all said and done, or one of the later meets in the outdoor season. Obviously, not going to take anything away from that meet. Wasn't obviously fully healthy. Didn't really have the ability to do much last season. I'm not saying I'm going out there and expecting him to rewrite the record book in the 60-meter dash of the first meet, but really excited to see if he's healthy and competing for the Cougars, the freshman, you said. And yeah, you mentioned Sean Maswangani, obviously has turned the most heads as a sprinter in his Cougar career, but having not competed that many times in the long jump, was second last year at AAC Indoor. So I think that's something interesting to watch, and whether you see more of him doing that or whether you see him focus more on sprinting. Obviously, whatever Sean does, he's going to be a showstopper. He's going to be one of the very best athletes and worth the price of admission.
He's not the only jumper that I'm looking forward to this year. Houston has some other guys coming back. Jaden Brome is your back-to-back AAC triple jump champ. He returns for his senior season, fellow high-level triple. What's that?
I was just saying Ben Okafor as well.
Oh, yeah. Ben Okafor qualified for nationals in the long jump a couple years ago. He's back, fellow high-level triple jumper. Quentin Stringfellow also returns. And then Houston adds Southern Utah transfer Frank Harris III. He qualified a couple years ago for NCAA championships in the high jump in the past. So definitely, you know, Maswangani, not the only jumper there. And then, you know, in terms of your hurdlers, definitely some interesting guys. Devion Wilson back, his fourth year in the program now. He qualified for outdoor championships in the 110 hurdles a year ago. And then DJ Akindele, another guy guy that is back for his fifth year in college, who's been kind of on the verge, pretty close, I think, is definitely a very much a threat to qualify for nationals. So I think as you kind of look at the jumpers and you look at the hurdlers, you got to kind of got, you know, some guys that have been there maybe once in the past in terms of qualifying for NCAA championships, maybe haven't quite gotten to the scoring points at championships, but I feel like there's a lot of guys there that you know, are not too far away, and that you could easily believe could have a breakout season and really be, you know, not only a force at the conference level but at the national level as well.
Yeah, kind of like you said, a lot of athletes who look like they could be in that year where they go from being good to very good to among the best in the country, which we've seen a lot in this program in the past. I think that's a big credit to the coaching staff, to Leroy Burrell previously, is that we've seen a lot of really consistent development going, you know, from that third to fourth year, fourth to fifth year, even probably fifth to sixth year for at least one of these athletes with COVID eligibility and what have you.
And then just a couple other guys I wanted to mention on the men's side while we're here. Pole vaulter Christian Sampi returns after qualifying and finishing 13th at NCAA indoor championships last year. And then, you know, we opened by talking about all the sprinting depth in the 4x1 relay, which is always a threat to win the national championship. But Houston's 4x400 relay also qualified for nationals last year. I think there's a little more work to do there, as they do have to replace a couple guys in Tyrell Valentine and Cavell Jordan. But Booker was part of that 4x4. He's back. Trey Johnson, part of that 4x4. He's back. And Houston adds an exciting freshman in LeBron Besick, who best event is the 400 and looks poised to help that group out right away. And then on the women's side, you know, Sam, the only place we can possibly start is with that throw squad. You know, I thought she was out of eligibility, but she's back. Priscilla Adejikun. And actually, it looks like she has eligibility in both indoor and outdoor season, actually. So Priscilla Adejikun back. Nua Uwasala Tuliafano, whose name I've never pronounced right once in the podcast, both back. They both qualified for NCAA indoor championships last year. Adejikun in the weight throw, Tuliafano in the shot put, respectively. So definitely a lot of women that we're excited about, but none more so than the two stars of the throw squad.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm really excited to see, how that continues. Both of them had really good breakout seasons. I'm curious if any of the athletes that we haven't mentioned, that we're not going to have the time to mention here, end up having breakout season. I know Tuliafano, I think, had a good junior college resume. I'm not saying that she didn't come in here with accomplishments, but I don't know if she was one of the first athletes we were talking about, and she had a really incredible 2022 season. So excited to see what she does, and excited to maybe see who this season's Tuliafano is.
And then looking at some other events, you know, in the sprints, Cecilia Tamayo Garza has been very close to qualifying for nationals in the past.
Someone I thought was out of eligibility. Someone I was excited to see when I saw the new roster as well.
Yeah, I'm excited to see if she can kind of get over the hump. This year, Houston also brought in Lanisha Thompson, one of the top JUCO sprinters in the country, to shore up their sprinting group. Cougs also brought in Kellyanne Beckford, was the D2 national champ in the 800 meters last year. Curious to see how she does with the transition up a level. And then some other events. Destiny Smith had a really impressive freshman campaign in the hurdles. She returns for the Cougs. And then the Cougs in the hurdles also add a freshman, Paris Baker, who won the 400-meter hurdles at the USA Track and Field National Youth Outdoor Championships. And then finally, the last woman I do want to mention was Destiny Lawrence, who was really impressive in the triple jump last year. Got real close to qualifying for NCAA championships. So excited to see, you know, like Tamayo Garza, if she can get over the line and qualify for the for NCAA championships. All right, and then before we leave, do want to mention a couple of other Cougar sports that have taken their winter break but are back in action here in the coming days. Cougar swimming and diving back in action on Friday in a dual meet against Miami and Florida Gulf Coast. It'll be Houston's first action since mid-November and their second-to-last regular season event before AAC championships in February. And Sam, should be a really good test for the Cougs. Miami ranked number 21 in the country right now, according to SwimSwam.
Yeah, good test for the Cougars with a conference tournament looming on the horizon. And always good to test yourself against someone who's going to surely be sending a lot of their athletes to the sports postseason as well.
And then speaking of opening up your January schedule by testing yourself, Cougar tennis back in action on Tuesday as they will be facing off against number 5 Texas A&M. Winter break also over, also back in action for the first time since November, but much more of the actual tennis season still remains. They'll be in action all the way up until AAC championships in February. But yeah, huge test to start out your schedule here as they face, like I said, number five team in the country in the Aggies. The Cougs have faced them each of the past four seasons. They've lost all four of those matches. Three of those were 7-0 sweeps, the other a 6-1 Aggie victory. So definitely an opponent who, you know, I think it's going to be less about winning or losing the match. I think we can, you know, love to be proven wrong here, but I think we can probably comfortably say the Cougs not going to win that one, but definitely curious to see, you know, how competitive Houston is able to be.
Yeah, I mean, if you take a point off the Aggies and a couple of the maybe singles losses are fairly competitive, I think I'm feeling pretty excited about the season. You've opened the last several seasons against A&M. Like you mentioned, you've only taken a point off the Aggies once since 2005. It was actually when these teams met back in January of 2020. And so I'm not reading too much into how the Cougs do in College Station, but, you know, who knows? Maybe this is a team that takes a point off the Aggies, and I think that's a positive sign as we get into the rest of 2023. And this is a team that returns a pretty veteran roster. Really, most everyone who saw action in a singles or doubles match last year is back, including your best doubles team, Azul Pedamonte and Blanca Cortillo, your singles wins leader as well, Maria Jemishkevich. You do lose Sophie Garrett, one of your vets from last year, but I would say still a pretty enviable amount of collective experience back for the Cougars. I think now the $64,000 question is, in your last year in the American Conference, are you finally going to be a bit closer to the Florida schools and SMU? I'm not even saying you have to be on those teams' caliber, because the Florida schools are pretty consistently in the top 25, SMU not far from it, but are you going to be closer to those teams, or are you going to continue to be one of the better teams in the tier below that? And I think that's kind of the question, kind of the what this team is going to be in the coming season. And I don't know if we'll learn a ton from facing an A&M team that's the preseason number five, but I think an interesting first test, certainly.
All right, well, that brings us to the end of what has been a very meaty episode, so I'll try to speed run through our closing credits here. On the way out, I'm going to give a big thank you to our Scott and Holman podcast Patreon supporters. We are starting to show, as we've mentioned, some of the show some of the thanks by doing those regular premium episodes, as well as doing what will now be a weekly podcast Patreon episode. Question every episode, I should say. So if you are interested in joining that exclusive club of fantastic humans who support the Scott Holman podcast, you can go to shpodcast.com/support. You will find a link to our Patreon page. You can also find a link if you don't want to do the monthly thing, you just want to send some cash our way one time. You can send us a tip via PayPal, or you can buy some merchandise with our street sign logo on it. We appreciate all those methods of support. Also appreciate you reaching out. If you want to say hi to us, you can email us shpodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet at us at shpodcast. That is the end finally of this lengthy episode. So thank you if you made it all the way to the end. You're awesome, and as always,
go Cougs,
go Cougs,
vamos los Cougs,
go Cougs,
go Cougs,
go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had to kick the door in. No cap, no cap,
no cap,
no cap,
no cap,
no cap.
Yeah!